How can stories of science fiction or magic help us recover from traumatic or challenging events? Here's Chicago writer Anjali Primlani.
Cultivating radical imagination is a very important thing right now, especially now.
We speak with her about her work in a new fiction anthology called Survivor. Plus, whether we're going to visit family or headed away on vacation, it's the time of year when lots of us are on the road or on a plane. Later this hour, we'll be talking about some new podcasts to help you pass the time. But first, the holidays can be a wonderful time to get together with family and friends, but it can also be, shall we say, stressful.
Isn't it enough that I'm making Thanksgiving dinner for everyone? You know, everyone wants a different kind of potato, so I'm making different kinds of potatoes. I mean, does anybody care what kind of potatoes I want? No! No!
Remember that episode of Friends? Coming up next, we're speaking with two therapists about how to maintain good mental health this holiday season. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, if you've got lots of travels ahead of you and need some ideas for how to pass the time, we've got a bunch of podcasts we want to share with you. We'll also be speaking with two Illinois writers behind a new anthology called Survivor. We've been talking a lot about Thanksgiving this week, in particular how we celebrate. The holidays can be a wonderful time to get together with family and friends, but it can also be stressful, as we've talked about yesterday with all of the travel that people are doing, but also dealing with family disagreements, the pressure of hosting, confronting feelings of isolation, especially for people who have lost loved ones. The holidays can be tough on maintaining good mental health in many ways. So how can you cope well? Joining me on the line now to discuss this is Dr. Christina Brown, chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Department at Adler University in Chicago. Here in our studios in Urbana is Pamela Wendt, a licensed counselor and the owner of Creative Solutions Counseling Group in Champaign. Christina, Pamela, thank you for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Christina, if I could start with you, I think there's this image that's been crafted around the holidays. It's kind of a very Norman Rockwell picture everyone has in their mind of what they think the holiday should be, which is family-centric and warm and fuzzy and perfect.
Right.
Do we start with expectations that maybe aren't particularly realistic when it comes to the holidays?
Well, I think we definitely have unrealistic expectations. And then to pressure that, you have everybody's competing expectations of what the holidays should look like. And that can especially be burdensome for the person or the family that's hosting the activities for the holidays.
And why do you think hosting in particular, I wonder how you think if you're hosting Thanksgiving, certainly that can be stressful in a lot of ways. What are good ways you think to manage that stress?
Yeah, I think that, definitely making sure that the host is taking care of themselves throughout, not, getting overwhelmed and tired. I know myself when I host Thanksgiving, I tend to try to ask everybody who's coming to make sure I'm sort of meeting everybody's wishes and needs. And I realize that that can just be too much. And so making sure that I'm prioritizing, what I want to have taken care of over the holidays. And that's really spending time together with family and however that looks. That's going to be what works for that family.
And Pamela, when we're thinking about family, sometimes that's great, sometimes that's hard, most times it's both, right? So when I'm thinking, first of all, I think a lot of people worry about disagreements that they have with their family. It's something that people worry about ahead of time. Sometimes they worry about it more than it actually happens. How much do you think that is a stress for people over the holidays, how much they're interacting with their family?
I do certainly think it's a stressor. Oftentimes prior to the holiday season, we see an increase in people coming in to discuss things that might be upcoming. Families getting together when they're not normally together for the year, having two close celebrations with Thanksgiving and Christmas also seems to heighten people and wondering, like, what are they really going to do? What kind of things are going to go on there? And so we talk about effective communication for each and every one of us, giving a person to say what they want to speak about, listening, and then also being able to tell the other person what you're thinking. And that's really helpful. If we can get people just to listen to us, we feel like we're heard, then that oftentimes negates some of the conflict that may or may not happen during Thanksgiving or Christmas holiday season.
Christina, I wonder how you think we can figure out when we're thinking about those communications. And I'm thinking in particular of politics. I think for the past couple of years especially, maybe people have avoided it. Do you think that's a good solution to not pretend that things are not happening?
I don't think pretending that nothing's going on is a good solution. I completely agree. And I think there's some couple strategies that you can employ when you're sort of talking about families. And two of the things I like to recommend are using I statements. So, when you're having those discussions and even those discussions about politics, to make sure that you're presenting it from a position of I think this or I see this or I believe this. And that helps so that your, whatever you want to talk about is landing in a way that can be received rather than when we approach someone with you do this or you think that, people tend to get defensive. And I think the other strategy, the second one, is we call those XYZ statements. And so that's when, if someone offends me, I might say something, when you do X, when you say this in this situation, Y, it makes me feel Z. So XYZ, when you say this, I feel this. And that really helps us take it away from being that defensive or escalating argument for family members.
Pamela, I saw you nodding your head as Christina was saying that. How much of this is also about not just giving people different tools of communicating and actual different phrases methods, as Christina was saying, but also just maybe stopping and taking a deep breath and not allowing things to escalate?
Correct. It's oftentimes helpful for people to stop, take a breath. We even utilize counting backwards from 10, giving your mind a little break, giving the other person a little break. Thanksgiving, especially if you're around the table and it's less likely that you have the ability just to get up and get out of the situation. If tone or volume increases, that's a time to take a deep breath. Also asking the other person, like, may I have the green beans, please? Or can you pass me another piece of turkey? Doing things like that around the Thanksgiving table, especially when food is involved. Sometimes that just gives everybody a break. Take a bite, take a drink of your water, giving you a moment to think.
Christina, what if you are a bystander to this? What if you are witnessing this happen? And I'm thinking particularly of maybe you're a parent who is having to referee between children or in-laws. What are the best strategies? Or you're the host. So what is the best strategy there?
I agree with the strategies that Pamela was talking about and really extending those to the host. So if I'm feeling as the host that, a conversation's getting too tense or I'm seeing that someone's getting upset or angry, I might employ sort of those same distracting comments. How about maybe it's time for dessert or pass the rolls. But it also could be an opportunity to be thoughtful ahead of time and maybe plan some conversation activities. There's different games that our families can play or different stories that family can tell, or sort of questions, that you can bring to the dinner table to sort of more direct the conversation to be about family and relationship, and maybe take away and move the conversations away from politics or other topics that can be hurtful or, cause problems in a family system.
And Pamela, I wonder for you what, certainly people can disagree and have productive disagreements. So we've talked a little bit about that. If it's not a productive disagreement, I wonder what are some signs that you think people should just kind of, things have gone too far? That's when you need to say, like, let's just talk about food. Can you give us some examples of when people should realize, okay, we're not going to go anywhere with this conversation?
I think there's three things that I think about with that conversation. One being the volume of conversation. So if you're sitting at a table in the living room, in the kitchen, and volume starts increasing, sometimes with that also comes tone. Tones tend to change when we're having disagreements. Word choice also may change when we're not agreeing things. So when we start to see those types of things happening with a conversation, it's much easier to say, for example, with Thanksgiving, what's something that you're grateful for that's happened this year? What's something that you did this year that you're really proud of? Tell me what's going on with your children. What kind of activities are they involved in? What are you looking forward to for next year? Positive things that we can talk about and kind of get out of the negative conversations.
We're talking about Thanksgiving and the upcoming holiday season with Adler University's Christina Brown and Creative Solutions Counseling Group's Pamela Wendt. You know, Christina, I wanted to ask you, because we've been talking a lot about family and how mm-hmm. this can be stressful in some sense. But I wonder also how many times the holidays can be lonely and isolating. And I'm thinking particularly about people who have maybe lost loved ones, especially if this is the first holiday season, or many times it's just a reminder in the holiday season of who is not with you.
Right. I agree. That can be a really tough time, both for people who are alone and are not near family members or don't have family, as well as for people who have lost family, whether it was more recently or, you know, in the further past. And so the holidays can be really a time to reflect on that. And, you know, it's also a time where families can create some ritual around family members that are gone. And how do you celebrate the lives that they had and that they shared with them, even though they're not there with them?
What kind of suggestions do you have for that in terms of creating rituals?
Great. So, I mean, going back to sort of the different stories that Pamela was talking about, that you could, you know, share favorite stories about that family member who's no longer there with them, or maybe that family member brought a special dish or had a favorite drink. And so making sure that you include those in those rituals moving forward. I think sometimes our inclination is to not talk about them, or because we're afraid that that's going to make people sad or upset. And I think really encouraging to bring those losses into the celebration can change the tone and how we, you know, how we approach the holidays coming.
And Pamela, when we're thinking about people who are isolated during the holiday season, and honestly, this is just a tough time of year. I'm thinking of the time change. I hate how dark it is now. It's always a little jarring to me that I look up at the office and it's completely pitch black outside, and it's what, 5 o'clock? So I think that's a really, they think, you know, for a lot of people, that's a tough thing to deal with anyway. And so I wonder how you think about people who may be, may feel already isolated or already have problems with depression, if the holidays might make things harder for some people.
Yes, certainly with the weather getting colder, we have less sunlight. That tends to lead people to feel not quite as good as they would if it was sunny and 78 degrees outside. To address the people that are alone during this or feeling alone, we talk a lot about resourcing. So who are your resources during the year? Is it a family member? Is it a friend? Is it a church member? Is it somebody at the Y where you go to exercise? So trying to stick with those resources that we use throughout the year. I think another thing, sometimes especially for students here at the University of Illinois, feeling alone if they cannot return home to their family of origin. Some people are left here, their roommates may be going home, and they may not have the opportunity to do that for a variety of reasons. For those people, I think it's good to be able to talk to your resources, but also be able to keep doing what you normally do. So with that, staying with your schedule. If you go to work, then continue to work. If you have other activities that you continue to do, really reach out and continue to do those things. If there are times that you are lonely, especially during the holidays, I think volunteering is a great opportunity. There are local food banks that love volunteers during the holiday season, serving meals for Thanksgiving and or Christmas to those who are less fortunate. Doing things in the community really helps your sense of self, as well as helping those other people in the community that are less fortunate.
Christina, do you have tips, too, for the time change for how to better cope with things?
I agree with all the suggestions, you know, making sure that you're keeping up that routine and then being forgiving of yourself if you're struggling or you're tired, and sort of listening to your body in response to that and how to take care of yourself. You know, most of my well wishes to colleagues and students this year have been including with what are the things you're going to be doing to take care of yourself, or what are those things you're going to do over the holidays that you may not have time to during the, you know, during the busy work or school weeks. And so that's been fun to hear about the different movies or books or TV shows that people are going to catch up on, as well as the friends and family that they're going to be able to see.
And Christina, to the point of people, whether they're actually alone or feeling alone, how do you think is a good way to reach out and help people who are in that situation?
Well, I think that that really is something that we need to take care of, every single one of us, and to make sure we're reaching out to the people in our lives who might be feeling alone who are alone, and see if there's ways we can extend, relationship to them or care to them, or even include them in our own holiday activities if that's something that works. And so I think rather than asking those who are, alone to, carry that burden, that we each take that on as well and make sure we're taking care of the people who are in our lives.
I just wanted to end by asking both of you, what are some things you do for self-care? If there's other things, Christine, I know you mentioned movies and thinking about all the fun things you do with your family. Pamela, I wonder if I could start with you. What are some things or other things you do or things you would recommend other people do as well?
One of the things I do when I have time off is meet with those friends, oftentimes that I don't have time during the work week. Things get really busy in our lives, and oftentimes we're giving of ourselves, but we're not taking care of us. And in order for us to really be truthfully giving to others, we need to take a little bit of time for ourselves. That for me includes sitting by the fireplace with nothing on, listening to music. I like to get massages, just things that I like to do. Taking care of me, giving me time just to kind of think about where I'm at, what I'm doing.
Christina, we're almost out of time. I wonder if you have one or two things you'd like to add as well.
For me, I like to go for walks. Both by myself and then with family members, depending on who I was willing to get off that in front of that cozy fire to come and join me. And so I like to do some self-care with movement and exercise.
Yeah, that's great also after hopefully to get out, get some fresh air, maybe get some sunlight. I want to thank Dr. Christina Brown, chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Department at Adler University in Chicago, and Pamela Wendt, who's a licensed counselor and the owner of Creative Solutions Counseling Group in Champaign. Thanks both of you for making time during this very busy part of the year to speak with us. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy
Thanksgiving to you.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. How can writing help us make sense of trauma or other challenges? And how can fiction writing in particular help us heal? Those are the questions behind a new anthology called Survivor, which features stories of not just pain, but healing, from military veterans, survivors of sexual assault and child abuse, to those who have lost loved ones. Co-editor Marianne Mohan Raj is with us from Chicago, where she teaches English at UIC and is director of the Speculative Literature Foundation. And Anjali Primlani is also with us. She's one of the 16 authors whose works are featured in this book, and another Chicago-based writer and artist. Marianne, Anjali, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Marianne, before we get into some of the specific stories and how this came about, for people who aren't familiar, can you tell us and share a little bit more about how you define speculative fiction and that whole world?
Sure. I have a pretty broad definition. I think of speculative fiction as anything that isn't strictly realistic. So certainly science fiction and fantasy, but it also includes magical realism, surrealism, fairy tales, folk tales, ghost stories, anything that might incorporate a not strictly realist element.
And how do you think of taking the reality out of this, let's say, helps people have the space or the freedom to write about some things that can be really tough or even traumatic experiences in their life?
All right, I'm going to use a little bit of an English lit term. So I teach a class in speculative fiction, and one of the things we talk about is cognitive estrangement, which is sort of the idea that When you move things into a different frame, a slightly not quite realistic frame, it lets you see things differently. So for example, I have a science fiction story that I wrote that was inspired by the Syrian refugee crisis. And I think if I'd written it about the Syrian refugees, people would have come to that story with a whole set of preconceptions, their own already formed ideas about that situation. By setting it in space with space whales and aliens with telepathic powers, it kind of takes it to a different area where you can examine the political issues with sort of fresh eyes and then hopefully bring that back to our world.
And so, Marian, this book starts with a recollection of an experience you had, one that I know really well, and that's being diagnosed with breast cancer, which is pretty terrible at any age, especially when you're diagnosed at a young age in your early 40s like you and I were. How did that change how you approached this project? How did that change your writing?
Well, you know, the book started after I was at a sci-fi convention and afterwards was talking with a friend. JJ's a disability studies librarian, and they had experienced a lot of bullying in their childhood. And so we kind of went back and forth discussing our own experiences. And it just seemed like science fiction and fantasy seemed like a natural way to explore a lot of these issues and give people a little space. Like sometimes it can be hard to talk directly about the traumatic experience. It can be very painful to look closely at something that maybe you're still processing. And certainly sometimes I might think that like, oh, I'm totally over the cancer thing. It was 4 years ago and I've done with treatment and so on, and then some little thing will happen and I'm suddenly right back there. Like I can't watch a TV show where someone's getting an injection, right? I'll be watching Grey's Anatomy and I have to look away from the screen because for a little while there were so many injections and I built up a resistance to them, and by the end of the chemo sequence I was actually needing to take Valium to be able to get myself to go and do what I needed to do, which, you know, I hadn't had a problem with needles before. So,
yeah, no, you and me both. it's a tough experience,
think,
yeah.
So that's sort of why I feel like the science fiction and fantasy give you kind of a safer space to explore the issues.
That's Marianne Mohanraj. She's the co-editor of this anthology we've been talking about, Survivor. Anjali Primlani is also with us. She's one of the contributors and writers to this anthology. Anjali, your story in this book is called The Day Anne Marie Went to the House, and it's about a young woman who has powers that mark her as different and the conflict that ensues from those differences. And you're a writer, not just of short stories. You've been a journalist, you've written a novel, you're a playwright. I wonder how a short story like this is different from the full-length plays that you're working on.
Well, it allows you to take a story and really focus it. I mean, this is a story that's about one turning point in one person's life. It's not, there isn't a huge scope to it. But it focuses on this young woman's decision ultimately to try to face the traumatic experiences that she's had and turn it into something constructive. And I don't want to say any more than that if anyone, you know, might give
me
away.
Yeah, no spoilers.
But she's, you know, it basically allows you to hone an idea down to a very sharp point. I didn't go into this thinking I wanted to write a short story. I knew that this was the story that needed to be written, and it sort of presented itself to me as a short story. It sometimes a subject or an idea will come to me and I will know what the medium is because it will sort of naturally sort of tell me what the medium is or what its natural length is going to be. Sometimes I'll think something's a short story and I'll discover I'm wrong. So in this case, it was a very short, very specific story.
And I do think the interesting part of this is that notion of conflict, which is somewhat similar to the full length. I know you're working on a full length play right now about religious conflict, right?
Oh, I actually have a couple of full length plays, one that is about the Second World War and about conflict in the Second World within people who have known each other for many years who wind up on opposite sides of the Second World War in Germany. The other one is about the partition of India. I seem to be really drawn to these stories where larger forces are trying to draw people into being enemies and their natural humanity tries to resist that. So that keeps sort of that's a theme that just keeps coming back to me. But
which is also a theme with this story, right? With Anne Marie, with your character, it's kind of there's a little bit of that
absolutely.
In this.
Absolutely. There's so much about this situation that is sort of driving her to remain passive and remain in hiding, and all of her friends and family are trying to protect her. And in a way, I mean, her mind is trying to protect her too. That is sort of what is happening in terms of her inability to actually even address things. Sort of, I mean, I don't want to give too much.
Well, I was going to say, I don't want to give too much away, but one of the most important, the pivotal part for me of the story was where she actually refers to herself in the third person, and then there's just tonal shift in the story where she becomes aware of herself as I, and then the perspective of the story actually shifts. And I wonder how much you think that disconnect can be a defense mechanism that we use to even sort of separate ourselves from what's happening.
Well, absolutely. I intended that to be a form of dissociation, that how she was able to cope with what was happening. I mean, there's indication that's also part of why it's also a symptom of her having other powers. They do talk about that, but the way that she copes with the fact that she has these powers, the consequences of having these powers, the losses that she experienced as a consequence of having these powers, the sort of loss of innocence that came along with it, and she's completely unable to sort of be in her own body and be embodied as herself, and literally can't be the subject of her own life because she's the object of everybody else's life or everybody else's. She's the object of everybody else's prejudices and opinions and attitudes about her until the day that she decides that she's not.
There's another story, Marianne, that deals with a person who's transgender but escapes to another planet to get away from his family. And it was so interesting to read this story within that realm of, okay, I'm going to be going to Mars and all these other places to get away from my difficult family. And I was even fascinated by the point of the pronouns that were used for the main character, Vin. And in fact, I don't even think gender is really even mentioned in that story. That to me was a really interesting way to think about this whole issue.
Yeah, I think science fiction fantasy is a long tradition of exploring these issues. There's actually the Tiptree Award is given every year at WISCON, which is the first feminist science fiction convention. It takes place in Madison over Memorial Day weekend, and it's an incredible convention. I go every year. But the Tiptree Award is for work that explores and expands our notions of gender. And I think for a lot of people, gender can be a little bit of a straitjacket, right? It is society can have very conformist ideas of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman. I think even if you yourself feel that you are cisgender, you might still struggle with a lot of that. And I think when that intersects possibly with sexual orientation, with queerness, I think I'm bisexual. I feel like I know a lot of people who did indeed have to flee a little bit. You know, they had to leave families that were not supportive, leave communities that would not let them be themselves or love the people they loved, and try and find a safe place elsewhere and create found family.
And when you think about that whole notion of science fiction and gender, I mean, there is, I'm thinking about Ursula Le Guin, like there's a really interesting tradition of this. I think even more so for a very long time in science fiction, maybe there's a longer history of this in science fiction than other forms of literature.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Le Guin, Delaney, I mean, a lot of the 70s feminist second wave science fiction writers were working with this and just questioning and saying, you know, why do we have to live in this way? Is gender really what society tells us it is? And, you know, some of that was, you know, I'm a woman. Does that mean I can't do these jobs? What if I did? Joanna Russ, everybody should read Joanna Russ forever, explored all of this really well. James Tiptree Jr., who was a woman, Alice Sheldon, who wrote under a male pseudonym, and famously people said of her that, you know, well, this couldn't have been written by a man, by a woman, because her men are so realistic, or these men are so realistic. And then when it came out that she was in fact a woman, people were very surprised. So I think, you know, science fiction has been it's a natural place to ask these questions. You know, what if we had 3 genders? What if we had 12? A lot of writers, I think, look to the animal kingdom as well for examples of, you know, the way human beings think we are is maybe not the only way to be. Nature has a lot more variety in it, and science fiction gives us a space to explore that.
Anjali, I wonder also how having these other lenses can help us see things or help us understand things or make sense of things.
I think, yeah, that's true. And I think cultivating radical imagination is a very important thing right now, especially now. My story is set in the town where I grew up, which is in the rural South, which there are a lot of people who would feel like if you're someone living in Chicago, you wouldn't have anything in common with people who live where I grew up. And there are things that are, of course, quite different, but there are also things that are very much the same. People are trying to get by. People are doing what they need to do. People fall through the cracks. These are kids who have fallen through the cracks. And in so many ways, we need to engage in these sort of acts of radical imagination to really sort of reconnect with our common humanity and remember who we all are. We can't go on the way we are. We can't just go on the way we are without being able to start looking at our selves through other people's eyes and looking through other people's imaginations. And culture is a part of that. Culture is in a very important part of that.
Marianne, I don't think this is the easiest reading. I think there's a lot of tough subject matter in here, whether the way that we're thinking about people going through the experiences that they write about here. But ultimately, these are all stories of hope. Is that why you think it's important for people to read this, Marianne?
I mean, when JJ and I put the book together, we had long discussions about this because we didn't want to put forward sort of pat, easy answers. We didn't want this to be a sort of like, oh, this is just going to be like, you know, I had this bad thing happen to me, now I'm all better, right? Like,
or this is the good thing I learned from it, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly, right. It's not chicken soup for the soul, not to criticize that book, but as a, like, that wasn't what our approach was. We wanted to put out real stories and that showed the struggles, showed sometimes there's backtracking. You think you've gotten to a place and then you slip back a little bit. But offering paths forward, I think, was really important to us. And, you know, when I think about this phrase Anjali used of radical imagination, I know environmental issues are super important to her. And I feel like right now we need this so badly. I'm listening to friends online who are in the Bay Area who are trying to figure out if they should drive 2 or 3 hours away so they can breathe better. As we look at what climate change is doing to our environment, suddenly we have all these new traumas to face, and we're gonna need radical imaginations to process them and to start looking forward to solutions.
That's Marianne Mohan. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Anjali. Yep, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to expand a little bit on something that Marianne said. People who study climate change deeply, who are scientists or engineers or other scholars who work on the subject a lot, are starting to have mental health problems and are starting to experience something that they're starting to call pre-traumatic stress disorder, because the more they're able to imagine what is happening to the planet, the more grief they're starting to feel for the things that we're going to lose that we haven't lost yet.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Thank you. Marianne Mohan-Raj is the co-editor of this new anthology that's just out now. It's called Survivor. She's also the director of the Speculative Literature Foundation, and she teaches English at UIC. I want to thank Anjali Primlani for also being with us, another Chicago-based writer, artist, playwright, and one of the contributors to Survivor. Anjali, Marianne, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much
thank
for having
you
us.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's the time of year when lots of Americans are spending time either on the road or on a plane, whether it's to visit family, maybe you're going on vacation, and you need something entertaining to pass the time. Well, podcasts are a great way to do that. We're big fans of podcasts here on the 21st. This morning, we've got some great recommendations from a couple of experts. Nick Kwa writes the Hot Pod newsletter and also writes podcast reviews for Vulture. Mayan Plout is a podcast librarian and content strategist with Radio Public. They help listeners discover new podcasts through their app. Nick, Mayan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
How's it going?
Thanks for having me.
Hey, good. And listeners, by the way, if you want to tweet us what you're listening to, we will share that with our audience. Our handle is 21STShow. Nick, let me start with you. Before we get to some of these recommendations, I think it's kind of crazy when you think about how much podcasting is in the mainstream now. Podcasts being turned into TV shows like Homecoming. And I was just seeing online this morning how the new Halloween movie has one of the murder victims as a true crime podcaster.
In fact, two murder victims.
Okay, sorry, we've given away the movie if you haven't seen it. But oh well, we've spoiled that one. Nick, what do we know about how many people are listening and also how diverse the podcast listening audience is becoming?
Well, there's a company called Edison Research, which does research into this question pretty consistently over the past 10 years. And the number of engaged or active American podcast listeners has steadily grown year over year. Right now, we're looking at around 57 million Americans listening, considering themselves monthly listeners. And that's sort of up 20% year over year. It's growing pretty quickly. But also, it's grown in diversity in terms of more African Americans listening these days and more Asian people listening these days. Podcasting used to have an image of being, white and male, and that seems like it's steadily changing.
I just wanted to ask you, obviously, it's your job to listen to podcasts, but how often do you turn to podcasts when you're traveling? How much do they help when you're driving or on a train or even if you're flying?
Most of my podcast listening happens while I'm traveling, actually. I find that the time in which I am in a place where I can focus on something is perfect for diving into a story or an interview. I am driving about 4 hours this week for Thanksgiving-related plans, and I'm already thinking about what's going to be on my playlist.
Yes, that's what I have. A couple things I want to ask you guys about, things that I have on my playlist. My best podcast listening is also in the car, and I have about a four-hour drive. Let's get to some of these recommendations, and this is a great one, Mayan. That's great for families. This is called Pants on Fire. This is good for playing in the car, especially if your kids are there. Let's just play a little clip from the beginning of an episode first.
Every week, and I'm talking about every week, we don't take weeks off. We don't take summers off. We bring on two grown-ups. One is an expert. The other, a liar. Yeah. And it's the job of a human child to help us figure out who is who. Because no one can spot a liar better than a kid. Maybe a grown-up could. Actually, a grown-up would probably be better at this. What are we lying about, Deborah?
Today we are lying about etiquette.
Oh.
The rules about proper or correct ways to behave. Lisa, do you know anything about etiquette?
Oh.
Yeah, I'll take that as a no.
Oh, sorry.
So, this is a podcast. As I like that they specify that it's human children that are involved with this. Is this in a game show format?
So the voice that you heard first is Lisa, the live in-studio audience robot. So it's very important that human children are the ones who are answering the questions around are these experts liars or real experts. It is a game show format, and there's a couple of rounds. The kids ask questions of both the
people that are on the show that week. And there's a couple of like computer-generated questions that the robot comes up with, but it's all very off the cuff. And I find myself listening very, very hard to try and figure out which person is a liar and which one is telling the truth, probably more so than any other podcast I listen to. It's very like fun to hear what the kids are trying to stump the experts with, and they usually ask early on in the show, like, how does this child lie, and how do they know if someone else is lying? So it's been this like beautiful arc of like watching people process what is truth.
Mm-hmm. That's great. We've got a recommendation from Amanda on Twitter. She says, I'm really loving CBC's radio. Somebody Knows Something, a really great and compassionate investigative podcast. Their most recent season is about a 30-year-old cold case in Manitoba. Nick, do you know Someone Knows Something?
I do. Yeah, it's one of the more studied true crime podcasts out there. They do a really, really good job every season, being very empathetic to the case and sort of digging into some of the emotional layers of the whole thing. It's one of the finer true crime podcasts for sure.
Great. Keep the tweets coming to 2NST Show. Nick, let's get to your first recommendation. It's called The Rewatchables from Ringer. And I feel like there are a lot of shows where there are hosts who are mostly men chatting about movies or pop culture. What makes this one worth listening to?
All right. So The Rewatchables is, I think, one of the more vigorous takes on the form. It sort of pulls in a rotating cast of writers from the Ringer's roster. And, you know, it's not just men. It's not just white men. Sometimes they do. It depends on the movie. It really depends on what each staffer brings to the table. But what I really love about the Pop Culture Podcast, which is a really sort of ubiquitous podcast, is the notion of just like sitting and obsessing over something. And there is a certain structural rigor that this show brings to the table. It has sort of really real enthusiasm about the things it covers, but it's also really tightly edited and well thought through. They actually really, the preparation is insane if you kind of like pay close attention to the way that each episode plays out in terms of structure.
Yeah, we've got a little clip actually of one, and this is where they're talking about The Social Network, the founding of Facebook, particularly timely these days. Jesse Eisenberg plays Mark Zuckerberg. This is Chris Ryan and Bill Simmons talking about The Social Network.
But I think the essence of the movie is essentially about this thing that was ostensibly supposed to bring people together was made by someone who had incredible social issues. And in fact, probably didn't like people very much.
Yeah.
And was not able to, in his real life, have friends. And that he created this thing that, on the surface, was supposed to bring us all closer together, but was driven by these sort of deep-seated emotions that were actually hostile towards humanity and hostile towards people's integrity and people's privacy and people's reputations. And that is actually bearing itself out. And that is, I think, an unintentional piece of wisdom from the movie.
Well, and it's also not what actually happened, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah, he's but I kind of sometimes candid. Like to print the legend.
It's almost like Sorkin's vision of what happened became the vision of what's actually happening. But in real life, Zuckerberg, he's basically like, I didn't start Facebook because of a girl. I started because I like building stuff.
Nick, I don't know if you've listened to that episode, but that exchange, I think, is a really good example of how rewatching a movie years later can be a completely different experience, right?
Right. That movie is so different now. It's like such a weird thing to watch. I was actually rewatching it a few weeks ago, and it feels darker now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Joel has some classic podcasts that he recommends, and a lot of them are public radio. So thank you, Joel. On Twitter, NPR Code Switch, Hidden Brain, 20,000, is it 20k.org, and The Moth. So those are, thanks, Joel. I think appreciate that. You can keep more recommendations coming to 2NST Show. Mayan, can I ask you about, this is a podcast I bet a lot of listeners haven't heard of. It's called Gravy, and it tells stories about food and culture in the American South. It's by a group called the Southern Foodways Alliance. What makes this show special?
Well, it's very special to me because I grew up in the South, and in my first like beginning to listen to podcasts, I didn't really hear a lot of voices that I was familiar with. And as soon as I heard Gravy, it like really pulled at these heartstrings of like the voices that I grew up with, speaking really like in the way that I think about food, which is that it's not just a thing that you eat, but it's a thing that you feel. It's passed down through generations. One of the reasons why I love the show so much is that I think there's like a monolithic like vision for people who don't live in the South of what the South is. And I love the nuance and the care that's taken with telling all of the stories of food and culture through gravy. My favorite episodes tend to be around communities of immigrants who are in a variety of southern cities, either like small towns or cities, because that is also like how I grew up, but also never really saw when people talked about the South. It's always like around the Civil War and like Reconstruction, and this is just like more realistic, like restaurant culture, eating in people's homes, cooking and sharing food together.
What it means to be a Latino.
Really like it around Thanksgiving.
Yeah, like I saw that one. There's an episode, I think, from the summer, what it means to be a Latino who grew up in the South. Like a very, I think maybe things people do not think about when they are not from the South. Thanks for that. Nick, your next pick is 30 for 30. So I think people have probably heard of the video series from ESPN. These are audio sports documentaries, but is this just for sports fans, Nick?
No, absolutely not. I'm a huge believer in sports as sort of a site for storytelling. It's a thing that draws a lot of people together, and it's a site for a lot of human experiences. And something that the podcast version of the 30 for 30 documentary series does really well is kind of spinning out into a bunch of different genres and attacking the topic from a bunch of different feels and tones and characters and protagonists and layers. This year, the series has put out a really powerful serialized investigation into Bikram Yoga and the controversial sort of allegations of sexual assault around that community. But it's also really flexed some strong muscles in its more recent season, which covers like an amazing spread of stories. Like this show really took the leap this year, and it feels like they've never been better in telling sort of straightforward or more complex stories.
That's a good reminder. I've been wanting to listen to that 30 for 30 on. Thanks for reminding me of that one, Nick. So not all podcasts you need to start from the beginning, but this one that you recommended is a full-fledged story. It's called The Magical History of Knox County. What's it about?
Oh, man, this one's so good. It was recommended to me very recently by my friend Ellie, and I listened to one episode and then listened to seven more in the course of the evening. It is riveting. So imagine Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, but in Ohio, reported on by a public radio journalist.
So it would be so
a familiar feeling for a lot of your listeners as well. I found it just, their sound design was really good, the characters are really compelling, and they managed to weave magic in like a really grounded way. Which I got from at least the first time I saw Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Speaking of fiction, Will on Twitter says he is here to recommend Greater Boston. He says it's fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, do you guys like that? He says it's
a
huge, amazing cast of characters and a plot that weaves together in ways that are brilliant, hilarious, and moving. Thanks, Will. You guys like that one, too. I wanted to ask you.
I love Greater Boston. I just moved to Boston, so Greater Boston was like part of my I'm moving here fiction sort of endeavor, and it's wonderful. The premise is that the Red Line secedes from the rest of Boston, so like one of the main like traffic arteries, and it becomes its own sort of like municipality, and what happens when people go there and what happens within it. It's so good.
Oh, sorry, Will is a she. My producers are telling me. Sorry, Will. There we go. Whoops. There. I wanted to ask you guys about, speaking of serial fiction podcasts, there's one that I've downloaded in preparation for my travels called The End. Have you guys heard of this?
Tell me more.
It's a dystopian, it's sort of a dystopian fiction serialized podcast that just came out. Nick, have you heard of it?
I'm afraid not. That's news to me.
All right. Okay. Well, I haven't listened to it yet because I've been saving it. So I will tell you guys about it afterwards. Any final recommendations? We're almost out of time. Oh, Nick, you had another one, a music comedy podcast called Punch Up the Jam.
Yeah. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to it because it's one of the sort of warmer and funner podcasts I've encountered in a while. It's by two comedians, Neil and Demi. And essentially, it's basically mystery science theater around old pop songs and old songs that have a maligned reputation. You know, Mr. Brightside from The Killers is a good example of a song that they kind of tackle, and what they do at the end of every sort of hour is that they try to sort of rewrite an improvise a new version of the song.
Oh my gosh,
It's really, like, it's impossible for people to think that quickly and to be that talented, but apparently there are people out there that makes you very, very envious, but also it brings you a lot of joy.
Oh, that's great. Okay, one last recommendation from Spencer on Twitter, who says that Spencer listens to podcasts mostly for in-depth political conversations, but the other one I listen to I can't recommend enough is The Adventure Zone, which is a D&D comedy podcast that is wonderful, funny, and creative. I don't know if you guys have heard of that one. Thanks, everyone.
Of our company.
Okay.
My favorite amongst my coworkers.
Thank you, guys. Thanks both of you. And I want to thank everyone on Twitter, too. Keep the if you guys on Twitter want to keep that thread going, we will keep that going and maintain it and retweet it out for all of our listeners. But I want to thank Mayan Plaut with Radio Public. She's a podcast librarian and content strategist. And Nick Kwa, who writes the Hot Pod newsletter. He also writes podcast reviews for Vulture. You can get the Hot Pod newsletter every Tuesday, right, Nick? And Thursday if you're a paid subscriber.
Indeed.
Thanks so much, guys, for being with me. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we will be wrapping up our Thanksgiving conversations with a great conversation between Champagne Rabbi Alan Cook and Imam Usman Sawadogo from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, talking about the interfaith service they celebrated earlier this past weekend in Champaign, and about the relationship that the two of them have this holiday season. You can always find past shows by going to the NPR One app, by looking at 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'll see you tomorrow.